It's now more than 7 years since somebody mailed deadly anthrax spores to news outlets and congressional offices and killed five people. The FBI believes they know who did it. Bruce Ivins, a scientist at Fort Detrick, Maryland, who developed the anthrax vaccine used by American soldiers in the first Gulf War. Ivins killed himself last July, leaving no confession, and many of his former colleagues believe he was innocent. Yesterday, the New York Times published a lengthy portrait of Bruce Ivins, described as an amateur juggler with mental illness, alcoholism, and secret obsessions with hints of violence. If you have questions about the investigation and its conclusions, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Scott Chain wrote the front page story in yesterday's Times and joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And you say that Bruce Ivins was revered by his colleagues as a rare ray of light.
Yeah, he was everyone recognized that he was sort of a quirky character. But a lot of people really liked him. He came across as a very caring person. He'd ask if someone had been out sick or if had lost a relative. He kept Hershey's Kisses in his office, and people would come by and get them. He was a juggler, as you mentioned. He also played the piano, and he would play a keyboard in his Catholic church on Sunday mornings and sometimes take it to an office party and liven things up. He sent lots of sort of joke emails around to friends. And, you know, like any government bureaucracy, USAMRID is the acronym for the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases. It could be a kind of a glum place. And people, I think, generally liked Bruce Ivins.
And one of those jokey emails was spelling out happy holidays with anthrax spores.
Yeah, that was in 2004. He sent out a sort of Christmas card by email and said something like, the spores wish you happy holidays, and sent it around. It's the kind of thing that I think, in the absence of the anthrax letters and in the absence of any suspicion from the FBI, people would probably sort of chuckle and think, here's a guy who was really into his work and had a sense of humor. Obviously, after the FBI's allegations, it comes across as perhaps a somewhat darker kind of gesture.
But even after those allegations, even after a lot of information about Bruce Ivins was made public following his suicide, after all of that, some of his colleagues really still believe he's innocent.
That's right. And they have some good reason to believe that. They knew him not only as a human being, but they knew him as a scientist, and they have some sense of what went on in his lab and what was possible, what wasn't. So I think you certainly have to take their doubts seriously. Four of his colleagues who had worked very closely with him for many years, all of whom have PhDs, wrote an obituary for the scientific journal Microbe that ran in November and praised him in very strong terms and didn't mention the allegations that he was essentially a mass murderer. So that gives you a sense of the depth of skepticism out there at Fort Detrick.
And the skepticism is based in part on the fact that the FBI for several years suspected another government scientist, a man named Bruce Hatfill.
Stephen Hatfill,
who, again, you look at the circumstances, wrote a novel about a bioterror attack and had other very suspicious things about him. And you ask a very disturbing question in your story. Had Dr. Hatfill committed suicide, as some people suspected he might at some point when the investigation got very intense, had he committed suicide, would the FBI have named him as the killer and closed the case?
Well, that is a question that haunts, I think, a lot of people associated with this case. I started covering the anthrax letters when I worked for the Baltimore Sun and covered the case pretty intensively in the first couple of years. And very quickly, even though there was some Islamist or pseudo-Islamist rhetoric in the notes that came with the anthrax, for various reasons, the FBI began focusing on a theory that this was a domestic attack, probably from some kind of biodefense insider. And increasingly, the scientific evidence accumulated that pointed to Fort Detrick, possibly to another one of a couple of other government labs or contractor labs. And so they started looking very hard at the core scientists at Fort Detrick, at the Army lab there, and Bruce Ivins was one of those people. The irony was that at the same time, the FBI, which of course began this process with very little expertise on bioterrorism, depended on Dr. Ivins and some of his colleagues for their knowledge, their technical sort of advice about anthrax, about how the powder could have been made and where it could have come from and so on. So from very early on, the scientists out there had this dual status of advisor and suspect. Stephen Hadfield had worked at that lab in Fort Detrick for a couple of years, from 97 to 99, and was himself a somewhat quirky guy, and some scientists out there had suggested the FBI take a look at him. And the FBI quickly put together what seemed like a fairly provocative, at least, but totally circumstantial case that perhaps he had done this. And some FBI investigators were quite convinced that he was the guy. But they could not close the deal. They found some provocative things. You mentioned the novel. He had on his resume that he had a working knowledge of wet and dry biowarfare pathogens. He kept a sample of an anthrax simulant at home and some notes on weaponizing anthrax. They found that he had filled prescriptions for the antibiotic Cipro, which can protect against anthrax, 2 days before each of the anthrax mailings. And they knew that he'd lost his security clearance about a month before the letters were mailed due to apparently a questionable polygraph. They also found a history of sort of exaggerating his qualifications. They found that he'd actually forged the PhD that he'd used to get jobs at NIH and later at Fort Detrick. So it was really, you can see why they took an interest in this guy, and they put a lot of resources into him, followed him around for years. Last year in June, they announced that they were paying him a settlement in a lawsuit that he'd filed.
Because they'd leaked information about his name.
Right. Technically speaking, it was not for because they'd investigated him. It was because they had violated the Privacy Act by leaking information about him. At that point, you sort of wondered, well, is this because they think they have the guy who really did it? And in August, they announced after Bruce Ivins' suicide that was the case.
Well, you said they could never nail down the case against Dr. Hadfield. Could they prove it against Bruce Ivins?
With Bruce Ivins, I think it's probably fair to say that the case is considerably stronger, partly because Hadfield was a virologist, and there was never any proof that he had done much hands-on work with anthrax. Again, he'd done a little bit of work with anthrax simulants. Whereas Ivins was an anthrax specialist, and for 20 years his job had been essentially to develop a vaccine, and part of that involved growing anthrax, essentially spraying it on animals that were vaccinated and using that to test the vaccine. So he was an old hand at anthrax, one of the most experienced people in the government with anthrax. But as with Hadfield, there was no single smoking gun, no single piece of evidence that could really close the case. As FBI officials have acknowledged, the letters were mailed in Princeton. They couldn't prove that Ivins had ever been in Princeton. He said he hadn't been there since 1959. They couldn't, the notes had been Xerox, had been photocopied. They couldn't put him, with a photocopier copying the notes. They couldn't find any evidence, a security camera or anything like that, that found him buying the kind of envelopes, pre-stamped envelopes, that were used in the attacks. So there were all kinds of possible items that could have nailed the case, and they couldn't find any of those. Now, they maintain that the accumulation of evidence surrounding Dr. Ivins, including a pattern of working late in the labs for several nights before each of the mailings, added up to proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which they believed they could present in court and use to convict him.
Well, that was opportunity. What about his motive?
The motive has always been somewhat obscure, but the FBI and others have long speculated that the motive might have been on the part of a biodefense insider, an American biodefense insider, to call attention of the public and the government to the threat of bioterrorism.
By killing people?
Well, there's some evidence that whoever mailed the letters may not have intended to kill or may have taken some steps to avoid that. Whoever did it put the word anthrax in the notes, put take penicillin in the notes. Now, if this were an Al-Qaeda attack, you wouldn't expect them to do anything that would warn people that they could take antibiotics and reduce the death toll. And there, you know, you can talk to folks who'd studied bioterrorism, worried about bioterrorism for years, and many people in the field were frustrated. They felt this was a terrible threat, and they feared that until there was an attack, no one would take it seriously. The irony, of course, is that if indeed that was the motive of these letters, it worked very well, and the government greatly increased the spending on biodefense and has spent about $50 billion since 2001 on biodefense. The irony there, of course, is that if indeed Bruce Ivins was the culprit, they've multiplied by 10 or 20 times, depending on what estimate you accept, the number of people and number of places where dangerous pathogens are being worked on. And assuming that, you know, in every 1,000 people, there's a couple with a screw loose, perhaps we have increased the threat of a biodefense insider.
Our guest is Scott Shane of the New York Times, who wrote a profile of Bruce Ivins, the man the FBI believes is the anthrax killer. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, email us talk@npr.org. Jeff's on the line. Jeff calling from Chesterfield, Missouri.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One aspect of this that I don't think has been discussed at all that I know of that I think might start to make some sense out of things is basically after the Democratic senators had received anthrax and other senators, one Republican I think as well, would that have allowed the government to start tapping their phones because they were the target of a terrorist attack? And if that is the case, boy, that really kind of opens up a whole can of worms. And when I heard that they wanted to wrap this whole thing up, you know, before the Bush administration was out with claiming Ivan was the one and he was dead and not too much we can follow, you know, up on after that fact.
Why would the government tap the phones of the victims?
Of the victim, yeah. Imagine being able now to have a reason to tap the
phone. What makes you think they did?
He got anthrax.
But, Jeff, what makes you think they did tap the phones of the victim?
Well, I'm just saying if they were doing an investigation and they were looking for the terrorists, they would probably try every venue and you know, to try and capture those people. And it would give them a legitimate right to tap their phones.
Scott Shane, any indication that the FBI tapped the phones of Senator Leahy or other congresspeople or the news media, for example?
No, I don't think there's any evidence of that. But this caller does raise an interesting aspect of this case, which is that there are many conspiracy theories out there related to the case. And many sort of amateur detectives who've made the case their own and many of whom have come up with a favorite suspect. Some of them focus on Al-Qaeda and people they think are associated with Al-Qaeda. Others have a former boss in the pharmaceutical industry who they never liked, who they're pretty sure is behind this. And one of the problems, of course, with Ivan's suicide and the fact that there won't be a trial is that, you know, in a sense, this is likely always to remain an open case.
An open case. Their colleagues of Bruce Ivins, as you reported, liked him a lot, revered him. He was a person they liked, but they did not know about, well, some other aspects of his personality. He had a penchant for secrecy.
He did, and he seems to have compartmented his life quite carefully. His family apparently did not know that for for decades, he'd had an obsession with sororities and their secret rituals stretching all the way back to college. He had gone in the late 70s, early 80s. He'd entered some sorority houses and he'd taken some kind of code book or secret ritual book. And more recently on the internet, he'd left all kinds of postings about these sororities. His brother told me that he had no idea, even though he spent a week each year vacationing with Bruce Ivins, his brother Charles. had no idea that he'd been in treatment for alcoholism, and he'd been in both AA and residential treatment. So he does seem to have been able to keep secrets and separate his life, which may strengthen the FBI's theory.
Yet there is still the question, did the FBI hound the wrong man to kill himself?
Well, that's certainly those of us who followed the Hatfield saga have that concern. Stephen Hatfield, according to his friends, was quite depressed and was drinking at the time the FBI focused on him. His friends described times when he would drive around Washington, and at times there would be a whole convoy of FBI surveillance vehicles following him. One of them actually ran over his foot when he was shopping in Georgetown, and Dr. Hatfield approached a car and the surveillance vehicle tried to take off and actually ran over his foot. The intensity of the scrutiny and the constant presence of these watchers, I think, would put anyone under a lot of stress.
Scott Shane, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Scott Shane's story on Bruce Ivins was published on the front page of yesterday's editions of the New York Times. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News in Washington.